Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Chilluminati Podcast, episode 321. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Mike Martin, joined by one of my best friends, Jesse Cox, and also special guest taking the seat of Alex today, RFK Jr. Thank you so much for being on the show.
I like Final Fantasy II the most of the Final Fantasies.
I'm really excited to talk about Tylenol and circumcision cause autism today.
I'm all right. You know, I'm good with that.
No, I'm good on this bit.
Oh, no, my connection's breaking up.
Yeah, I don't want to do this bit. that guy sucks. And you're stupid if you believe in him. And Cheryl Hines is out.
Final Fantasy VI is the greatest Final Fantasy.
Oh, no.
What do you think the Final Fantasy of the right is? Like, just as entertainment, like, what do you think? Most people
what
who voted
their
for
game
Trump
is like what
if
their they like,
what is if, the if you the like best Final Fantasy?
If you like Final Fantasy and you voted for Donald Trump, your
what
favorite
is
Final
their
Fantasy
favorite Final
is,
Fantasy? Oh, interesting question.
I think it's Final Fantasy VII. Sorry,
no way. The eco terrorist. Actually, you're absolutely right. They did not read into
it's
that.
Like Rage Against the Machine.
You are.
They 100% did not.
Damn, are. I was gonna say 8, maybe. Like, I can see 8.
Nobody's favorite Final Fantasy is 8, except for Michael Davis,
and he almost went down the alt-right pipeline thanks to fucking Star Wars. So,
interesting shit. They try and get you racist. They try and make you hate
the conspiracy theories. That's been our battle for 7.5 years in this damn show.
We're trying to save you by acting like assholes all the time. Like we're trying to save you by acting like stupid idiots all the time to keep your third eye open. You're welcome. Our real selves, we're super serious, no nonsense guys in real life. We walk through our normal day.
No nonsense.
We cross our T's, we dot our I's, but here we fool around super to teach serious. You how to have fun. How to find mystery in the world again.
We also uncircumcised.
Also, I just became an old, like, oh boy.
Yeah. I mean,
Trump was already okay, here we go.
Yeah, yeah, Trump was already like 50% Trump, 50% like.
Oh, I can't do one because I don't do one. That was a first of its kind right there. That was
Ed
Bighead's first attempt.
Yeah. That was Big Head's wife. You're right. Yeah. That was Big Head's wife.
Oh, Rocco.
Yeah. Wow, that's a 10 out of 10 impression right there.
Oh, boy.
You got that and Alex's Rolf. There you go. Then we can always have them as special guests at any point.
I voted for Kamala. Don't blame me. Okay. I didn't vote at all.
Okay, we got to get down.
They
to the
already pick who's going to win way in advance.
If the prices of dog food have gotten higher. It's not my fault.
If you want to
eat flies, and there's plenty of those.
All right. If you want to get Jesse and Alex back, head over to patreon.com/Chilluminati Pod so we can pay them to come back.
Not
to the
even
show,
worth
please.
It.
It's definitely worth it. It's a wonderful place. It's a restaurant?
What?
You said it's a wonderful restaurant?
I'm just doing little bits just for myself. Don't worry about it.
Oh, okay. You're off on your own, looking away, off
it's
away
just
from the
for
mic.
Me. It's I'm just for you. It's, oh, this is my Kirby. First day of the year where I've worn a jacket. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it just, I'm in a whole other headspace right now. I feel like a hobbit. I feel my hibernation brain is turning on. I'm getting dumber by the minute as it gets colder. Yeah.
Perfect for this show, actually. Yeah. Also, for Patreon, we're going to be doing a Neil Breen movie next, I think. But also next month, Age of Disclosure finally releases. And you bet your fucking bottom dollar we're going to be watching that on Rotten Popcorn. I can't wait. That movie was supposed to be out almost a year ago.
I hope when we watch it, we're sitting there in the rubble of our previous worldview.
Yeah, me too.
And we're just thinking, wow, aliens are here. That's what I want.
Is it weird that when I hear the phrase Age of Disclosure, it makes me think of like the subtitle of a really shitty movie.
It makes me feel like your marketing brain kicking in as it
like
should be.
Age. It makes me feel like all the normal Marvel comics stop being
Fast
published.
Fast and Furious 11, Age of Disclosure.
Age of Disclosure. Yeah. like they don't publish Spider-Man. They don't publish X-Men. They don't publish any Fantastic Four. It all stops. And then there's like Age of Disclosure version of everything.
Yeah.
I love
and
that.
And they change, you know, Reed Richards is like, He's got like a, he looks like a gray now. He has like the big orbit head for some reason.
Magneto's a tall light for some reason.
Oh, no, for some reason. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it's this personal hell. All right. No, we gotta talk about the show, boys. We gotta get on the episode because today is the second and final part of the Vampire Killer of Sacramento.
I'll admit
Richard
it.
Chase.
I was killing time trying to get away from the animal Coca-Cola slurry. I don't want to get back
there.
Yeah,
we'll revisit that. that slurry briefly at the more toward the end of today's episode. I don't want to
revisit the slurry. We can leave the slurry in its cup. I don't want to sip it. I don't want to see it.
I'm not going to make you sip it. I might make you sniff it.
Okay. All right.
What?
Hashtag sniff the slurry. Hashtag. Huh? Remember hashtags?
Nibblable slurry.
Yeah, I don't like that.
Thank you so much to Cash App for sponsoring today's episode. And let me tell you, if you're looking for a really easy and fast way to be able to send money, receive money, and all kinds of stuff, then Cash App is the way to go. Seriously, it is a game changer. I love how convenient it is to just send and receive money. Plus, the Cash App card, it's not like just a card. It's a whole thing. You can even personalize it. I've been thinking about what I'd put on mine, and I don't know. I'm not super creative, so like, I don't know, like a alien, probably. Is that normal? Cash App is more than just a safe way to send and receive money. With the Cash App card, you get tons of perks without hidden fees. Things like early access to concert pre-sales, like Kendrick Lamar and Sabrina Carpenter, plus discounts on everyday purchases at brands you're probably already spending money on. It also keeps your money safe by automatically flagging suspicious transactions and letting you lock your card instantly if it's ever lost or stolen. For a limited time, new Cash App customers can earn $10 if they use code CASHAPP10 in their profile at sign up and send $5 to a friend within 2 weeks, 14 days. Terms apply. Cash App is a financial services platform, not a bank. Banking services provided by Cash App Bank Partner. Prepaid debit cards are issued by Sutton Bank and member FDIC. Discounts and promotions are provided by Cash App, a Block Inc. brand. Visit Cash App Legal Podcast for full disclosure. What are you waiting for? Download Cash App today by using the link in the description and pinned to the comment below. Trust me, it's gonna love you. It's gonna love it. Thank you, Cash App. Yeah, thank you, Cash App. Well, welcome back to the horror show of this topic. In part one of our series last week, we talked about Richard Chase, and we charted like the complete journey from birth to his disintegration and his falling apart psyche. We started with his poisoned environment of a home, with his abusive disciplinarian father and a mother that was having constant paranoid delusions that her husband was trying to poison her, even at one point thinking his mistress was hiding in a bush while they were on vacation together, which also like kind of was a seed that was planted in Richard's mind at a young age. And then we followed his path as he grew up. We saw him exhibiting the classic but terrifying precursors of the McDonald triad, which is the bedwetting, fire starting, and the early but compulsive torture and killing of animals. It's the McDonald triad again, as we said last episode.
The basic stuff, you know? The basics,
as we said last week, the McDonald triad is out of date, which is why we don't really talk about it anymore. But he is basically the founder. Yeah. He was like a textbook case for this. And he also had his own burgeoning paranoid schizophrenia coming on, also, which was accelerated by his marijuana and LSD use, which was quite heavy. If we remember, we talked about that last week as well. Remember, he was having like full on somatic delusions, too. Hearing voices, seeing people, thought his body itself was failing him, disintegrating from the inside. His heart would stop because his pulmonary artery had gotten stolen. His blood was slowly turning to powder in his veins. All stuff that he fully, fully believed was happening to him. And this is the thing that would eventually be the reason he started murdering, or at least the reason he gave himself that he started murdering people, because that's how he would replace his blood first with
animals.
That's
actually a great way of describing it, is just the reason that he gave himself, because let's review.
Yeah, please.
None of it was happening. He just decided that his blood was powder.
It's the only answer, man, that made sense, Alex.
Yes, the only answer in his world, in his reality, that made any goddamn sense.
I don't even really actually understand the logic of it. Why does it become normal? If you have powder, right, and that's your blood.
Yeah, it's turning to powder.
Right. So that is blood, though. That is the powder, right?
Yeah.
So the answer is you drink other blood to make the blood back into your blood. Doesn't make fucking sense.
It doesn't turn your blood back into it. It takes the blood that you swallowed and puts it all in your veins and refills it with that blood.
It makes it more liquid.
Was he only sucking the blood of people of his own blood type?
No, it started with animals.
Right. That's exactly what I'm saying.
He tried to inject rabbit blood directly into his veins and got blood poisoning.
This is exactly what I'm saying. The very logic of it, even if I'm going to entertain the concept of my blood being powder for a second.
Sure.
All I want to do is have maybe like some water, right? To maybe reconstitute it like Kool-Aid into blood.
Yeah.
Right. So that my blood returns.
Here's my theory. He was mentally ill. Like, I just think, you know,
hold you, on now. Mentally, you have no evidence of that.
There's no, that's the other part too. Yeah, is like, what led you to believe
that he's mentally ill?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I thought the two times he was put in a facility and let go, both times, you know, the second time they let him go after he bit the heads off of birds and was drinking.
They said,
the blood.
Well, man, you're cured.
Yeah, you're after a year. Home. Okay. You got a year on that second go.
Well, dude, that's it. We've done all we can. You're back.
Remember, he was even found by police at one point near Pyramid Lake that when he was covered in cow's blood, armed with a gun, completely naked.
I didn't forget. I can't believe I can't believe he lived. I can't believe he lived through that. Yeah. If I saw that come out of the woods and I was holding a firearm.
I don't think he'd live nowadays. Maybe. Depends. He's white.
I'm just saying, if I was holding a firearm and a man came out of the woods with a weapon and covered in blood.
I know.
I don't know what I would have done.
But it, just to close out this recap, we ended last week with Richard Chase having purchased his 22 caliber pistol by lying on the federal form. He was fully unmedicated again after getting out of the psychiatry ward, thanks to his mother's direct intervention of weaning him off and then kicking him out. And then he was operating on his own internal logic of wandering neighborhoods and checking for unlocked doors. Because an unlocked door.
Their fault. Yeah, that's their fault then.
Well, that was a direct invitation by them to him to come inside. And the very last thing we saw him do was his like test run of shitting in a baby's crib.
Do you think a real vampire can manifest an invitation like that? Do you think like a real vampire could convince themselves that they've been invited in by a door?
If we're looking at Vampire the Masquerade 5th edition rules, there's a legacy flaw one could take as a player.
Of course.
That's like like fairy tale restrictions on vampires.
Legacy flaw?
It's called a legacy flaw. Yeah, it's like you can take it and it'll give you like one of the romanticized problems vampires have, like not being able to be invited in. And I don't think you can logic yourself away around it. You have to have the other person directly saying,
if you believe that you've been invited in, if you believe you've been invited in,
it's a supernatural restriction, right? Like it's not a psychological restriction. If you're not invited and you step through, you likely start taking, well, in Vampire the Masquerade 5th edition, aggravated damage, and that will kill you.
So the person has to want you to come inside.
Yes.
Do you think
they have to invite you in? They have to invite you in. They may not need to want you to come inside, but they still have to invite you inside.
Do you think he knew about the Masquerade 5th edition?
I don't think so.
Do he had a legacy flaw?
This might be his legacy flaw. This might be where it came from.
Okay. Just wondering. Just figure out it.
I appreciate it.
Just trying to build the bridge back to the plot. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, we found it.
Yeah.
So the last thing we talked about was he shit in a crib.
There it is, the plot.
There it is, the plot. He shit in a crib. And the crib incident was just kind of just a pure expression of his rage and contempt.
I'm so glad nothing in my life is called the crib incident.
The crib incident? Yeah, dude.
That rules.
There's no way you can take something called the crib incident and at all make it good. Like, there's no good crib incident. And I don't know if it gets... Like, it can't get much better than shitting in a crib.
I mean, unless you're a baby, in which case... All right.
The crib incident, that one time the baby went to bed peacefully and didn't make a sound? No.
Yeah. Like, the crib incident is when
the baby took a shit all over the crib or something.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, this crib incident, while thrilling to his inner rage and hostility to the world, did nothing to satisfy the all-consuming physical need his psychosis had created in his mind, because his blood was still in his mind, slowly turning to dust. And so the hunt that followed was no longer for him just a thrill or a place to leave his mark. Now he's truly in survival mode in his own psychosis. He was now like on a mission to make sure he got blood so he didn't end up dying.
He's basically just chaos magicked himself into being Voldemort. Like he has like become a slithering predator of men. Because he believes he must do so in order to further his existence like an animal. That's so fucking...
And I left out... How do there's you other get stories there, with him and his mom and stuff that I left out. And I don't think I actually mentioned my sources last week because I kind of just jumped into the actual story. So shout out at the very top of the episode to the main source for this one, which is A Thirst for Blood by Lieutenant Ray Biondi and Walt Heacock. Great book for this. It really goes over the case.
Did not bury the lead on that one.
It's very, very good. And there's a lot of stuff that I left out with his mom and stuff. Like, if you ever want to obviously learn the entire story and every horrible thing the man did, feel free. But we were already almost at 2 hours last week. I felt like it was probably good to not talk about
it. Chill
everything.
On the Coke slurry. Like, that was as far as I ever was ever needed to go. I forgot about it. Right. Like, after last week. And then my wife, Kelly, like, listened to it and was like, dude, that was a lot. Right. And I was like, oh yeah. Like, I fucking completely forgot that happened. And then I was reminded and it was just as bad again.
Yeah. It's never good. It's not going to get any better this time around either.
Oh,
it's only going to get worse for the people who are very squeamish and not, you know, cannot handle like violence much. It's a very violent episode this
month.
Happy
Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
Patreon.com/IlluminatiPod.
So we find ourselves back on December 29th, 1977, only days after, remember, his mother rejected him from coming inside. So he tore a cat with his bare hands in two in front of him on the front lawn.
Where
his mother silently cleaned up the cat's corpse, shut the door, locked it, and still did not let him inside, but also did not contact anybody or any authorities at all.
I remember.
Yeah. And so days after that final rejection from his mom, he found his first human target. His victim was Ambrose Griffin, a 51-year-old engineer. He was a husband, a father of two, and by all accounts that I could find, just a completely normal dude, a respectable home, like, family man. He had no criminal ties, no known enemies. He was just kind of existing, going about his Monday tasks of his normal life. And that afternoon, Griffin had returned home from work and was in his driveway in East Sacramento, unloading groceries from his car. And it's just a pitch perfect suburban normal day when all of that would be completely shattered, because as he stood there, his car quietly pulled up to the curb. There was no exchange of words, no robbery demand, no confrontation at all. Just a car pulling up, stopping, and from inside the vehicle, Richard Chase raised his .22 caliber pistol, fired a single shot that struck Griffin in the chest, and then simply drove away. Ambrose Griffin immediately collapsed on the pavement, and his killer was gone.
What the fuck? That is, yeah. I know that's so simple, right? I know that's right. Just like,
it's the most simple out of all of his kills that he's got.
But that is so chilling in another
yeah,
way.
That's, yeah, I agree. Like, that's even, because like, what do you do, right? Like, it's a dude who pulls up. He's there for 10 seconds. They don't know each other. He doesn't know Richard Chase. Richard Chase did not stalk this man. It was a random thing. Just pulled up on a day where you're grabbing groceries, you pull a pistol, pop them, and drive away. As a normal person that just like lives your day to day, that's a horrifying
thought.
That
can happen to anyone.
Anyone,
you can get killed in any stupid way.
Right.
The interesting thing about this is that the progression seems to be break into a person's home and poop in a crib.
Yep.
And then the next thing is drive by shooting, which to me is fascinating mentally for him, because it shows what like he needed to do to build up to this. He is still cowardly in that
100%.
He sneaks into the home and he's freaking out and he's like, well, I got to see what I can do. So he takes a dump in the crib and then pieces out.
Yep.
And his next, but he like, he wants to kill. He wants to kill so badly, but he can't bring himself to kill.
Yep.
Yeah. And so he poops in a bed. Now he's like, well, I got to kill. But he's still too much of a coward to face a person and kill them.
Yep.
So he drives up. He's like, I got to get a kid out of the way. And just pops a dude, drives off. It isn't even about the guy. It's about him coming to terms of like, I have to kill people.
He's baby dicking
I have
it.
To do yeah. this. So this is my first kill.
And in another one, we never really get an answer as to why he killed this guy. But unlike the other ones that are to come, there's no ritual. There's no blood, like, you know, drinking or whatnot. And there's theories, and we'll talk a little bit about it in the script that I wrote here. But like, it's also, it's like only one that was like kind of a pop and run. And I think you're right. Again, it's the serial killer. I think he's a serial killer who's just dominated by a psychosis. And so he's still dominated by his rage sometimes. And that's where you get the other random acts of shitting in the crib and stuff. And this is another one where he'd been rejected by his mother 4 days prior. He's utterly pissed off. And this is his, I'm going to do it. But he, like you said, he's too much of a bitch to get out of the car and like give the person any sort of a chance of like knowing what's about to happen. And the whole time
it's not about a fair fight. It's about like, I'm going to kill someone. That's it.
Yeah, exactly. And Griffin's wife was actually in the house when this happened. She said she heard the sharp popping like sound, but her mind thought logical, nonviolent explanation, a car backfiring or something.
Sure.
And so when she looked outside and saw her husband collapse in the driveway, that she realized something was completely wrong, but still her first assumption wasn't a gunshot. She thought sudden catastrophic, like heart attack. Like he got shot in the chest. He fell to the ground. But obviously the truth was that it was just, he got shot in a cold, completely random murder. And there was, when paramedics and a police arrived, it was a little bit too late for Sacramento Police Department. Also on this, the murder of Ambrose Griffin was what they called a ghost crime because it had no known motive, no witnesses, no connection to the victim, whose wallet and possessions obviously were untouched because he didn't get robbed. The wife didn't see anything.
It's like an nightmare. Yeah. It's like
the thing. Yeah. The thing I think we've talked about
shark attack. Yeah.
In our true crime episodes before and serial killers. But, you know, this is another good example of that is like the reason serial killers often get caught is because they usually stick within their living distance and they usually have a type, a stalking method. And cops are usually, they usually fuck up along the way also, which allows them to get away for a long time. But there usually is a pattern. Especially back in the 60s and 70s, when surveillance is not nearly as dominant as it is today, you have like a GPS in your pocket at all times. Like to just drive up and shoot somebody and drive away with no reason to, you have no connection. The cops have nothing. There's nothing they can fucking do other than obviously file a report and keep an eye out. They don't have any way to deal with this at this time. It's crazy. It's a detective's worst nightmare at this point. And the victim, like I said, had no connections that would point to a hit, like a crime of passion. No mistress on the side that would have been like, I'm going to kill him for, you know, not leaving him. It was just randomness, an absolute absolute random chaotic act. No, with nowhere to go. It was a dead end. The cops canvassed the neighborhood, but no one had gotten a good look at the car or the driver. The whole thing was over in an instant. The case was, for all intents and purposes, just dead on arrival. And to the police and the public, this was a really disturbing but bafflingly isolated incident. It was a statistical anomaly in a very quiet suburb, and they didn't really have a way to react to that. What they didn't know is that it was just the opening salvo to about a week and a half's worth of violent terror run across this area. From Chase's perspective, though, the murder was both a success and a failure. It was a success in that it was a massive release of that homicidal rage that we were just talking about that had been building up inside of him thanks to his mother's rejection. And this was him crossing a final line. He had also now proven to himself that he could kill a human being. And just like at Pyramid Lake, he had gotten away with it seemingly with simple ease. And in the one way that truly mattered to his psychosis, it was also a huge failure. A drive-by shooting is a distant and very impersonal and cowardly act. He didn't get his hands on the victim, he didn't perform his ritual, and he didn't get any blood, which was the most critical thing. And the central delusion, the powdering of his veins, was still like tormenting him in his mind.
Yeah, just realized that, yeah, he kind of failed. He killed a guy, but the whole point of killing for him
to take the sip
is to take blood.
Right. He needed to get his little Coke slurry on.
Right, which shows the dichotomy between the psychosis and the rage killer that is actually still would, I think, be there regardless of his psychosis.
It's the justification just fully slipping. It's just him totally proving to himself, or to at least to the listener, that he doesn't care.
But for him, this also kind of like, in a way, taught him a lesson. Because if he was going to get the cure that he so desperately needed for his psychosis to be satisfied, killing isn't enough. He needed to harvest the person.
Do you think he was worried about it in an earnest way? You don't think he was just saying it because he was actually just feeling the need to kill and was saying, oh, you know what? I got to eat this. I got to drink this blood, instead of saying, I would love to kill someone right now.
There's nothing about him so far that says that he would do, like, you know.
He's not lying about a psychosis. He's just not.
No, I don't mean psychosis. He hasn't like done anything. He's lying about it.
Isn't related to it, I think, is the thing.
I do think it bothered him. I do think he let the rage win out and it like muted it, whatever, because it's just that boiling red rage. And when he went back and realized it didn't do what the psychosis demanded, it started to gnaw at him. And it started to like, because like he still believes his shit is like dusting in his veins at this point. And so after that first attack, after getting away with it, the next attack he decided would have to be different. So he knew he couldn't do it from a car, that he would have to get inside the thing he'd been practicing opening doors for so long. So for the next 3.5 weeks, the city of Sacramento existed in a constant, uneasy, unaware quiet, because the police still had no leads during that time and the public had no idea that this random killer was not a one-off thing. They didn't know that he was still out there and that he had merely gone back to being patient, methodical, walking the streets again. He started testing doorknobs again,
yeah, it could have been fucking anything.
Rebuilding it up like he did last time. Very serial killer-esque of him. For Richard Jase, like, this is all that mattered now. The next kill meant that his core driving delusion had to be sated, because now it wasn't just a passing thought. This is a terminal mind, a terminal condition that would be killing him if he didn't harvest anything. So after that kill on the 29th of December to late January is how long he tested doorknobs again, hunting again, not finding anybody. For 3.5 weeks, he didn't actually pull the trigger. But on January 23rd, 1978, his patient hunt finally did pay off again. His quote-unquote invitation came from a 22-year-old woman named Teresa Wallen. She was a newlywed, and worse off, she was 3 months pregnant with her first child.
And when you say that, you just mean her door was open.
Correct. Oh, yeah. Air quotes invitation. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, there was no real invitation here. His invitation is his psychosis being like, I found an unlocked door. She had just, like, they had just began their happy little domestic life. And on that day, she was home alone, doing just mundane chores. She was taking out the garbage. And just taking out the garbage, that simple act that all of us do many, many times over the course of our lives, she accidentally left her door unlocked when she went back inside. And that moment, lapse of caution, is all that was needed for Richard Jase, who was prowling her street at that time. And that unlocked knob was the invitation that he had been looking for the past month. So he slipped inside her home, silent and unseen, and waited. We do not know the exact sequence of the next few moments. We don't know if he hid and waited. We don't know if we don't know if she walked back in to find him standing in her living room. He basically slipped in while she was taking the garbage. At the latter, people say that is more likely that sucks. He was just in the living room waiting, because the sight, like, he just walked in. And again, if you remember, the sight of this man is filthy. He's emaciated. He's got the sunken, crazy look that he has in this arrest photos that we've seen. And all he did when she stepped back in was raise his 22 caliber pistol and shot her 3 times in her quiet suburban home. And the life of Teresa Wallen and her unborn child.
What kind of gun was that?
A 22 caliber pistol.
Like a little baby gun.
Yeah. Like he shot her 3 times like at close range. Handgun. But yeah, like a handgun. Because his hunting rifle was 22 caliber hunting rifle. And then he got the pistol instead after that. You're going to look up what it looks like. Yeah, I forget what it looks like, but you can look
like
it up.
Like a police officer's gun, like a gun.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, but he's, but you were saying before gun. That he had a rifle. So he's using like gun is a, I didn't, you know,
let me
what
put
I mean.
It this way. So the rifle was when he had was with the cow. He got arrested. The rifle was taken away. When he got back out of the psychiatric ward, he went and bought the pistol.
Understood. Okay.
All right. Just to reline it up in case people did, you know, I lost him there. So, yeah, he shot her 3 times. The life of both of them were lost. But this was just the start, because now he was going to do the ritual. The murder, again, this is when he would consider him a product killer. He's very much after the body. He's left less interested in the act of killing itself. And he had what he finally wanted too, a secure location with a fresh victim and time. So what he did next was honestly, is a list of psychotic, ritualistic violence. He was acting out every fantasy that his madness had concocted over the many, many years. First, he dragged her body from the living room into the bedroom. And from there, he sexually assaulted her corpse for a while.
Yikes.
This was the...
For a while.
Like, we don't... there's no timeline other than, like, what autopsy reports say. Obviously, we don't know. This was also, like, him... this is, again... more evidence of his physical, like the physical manifestation of his serial killer tendencies, that sexual rage that even Jesse brought up end of last episode, that a lot of this is tied to his impotence from his youth. Here is shown bright and broad in bright daylight. That
she can't
exactly
mock him if she can't talk.
Yeah. Exactly. There's nothing he can do. And so he just assaulted her and desecrated this home. And after that, he then went to their kitchen, found a butcher knife, and returned to the bedroom where he stabbed her body repeatedly
with the
butcher
knife
over and over again. Again, another expression of that same deep, violent rage that just sat underneath. Then, driven by a central delusion, he began to mutilate her body. He cut off her nipples. He sliced her abdomen open and disemboweled her. Then he started harvesting the inner organs. He then returned to the kitchen and searched for a container. He found a small, empty yogurt cup, a detail that seems so mundane and it becomes kind of like grotesque in its own way. And he brought the yogurt cup back to the bedroom and used it as a sort of makeshift chalice for his ritual, scooping and collecting her blood from her body cavities that he created. Then he just simply drank it. This was his cure. This was the act he believed was so necessary to replenish his own powdering blood. He also cut out and consumed several of her internal organs. Like this was a full-on ritualistic psychotic act. And again, he was somewhat under control when he was on his medication, when he was out. Like he was doing slightly better. Before leaving, though, he smeared the remaining blood on the bedroom walls and just like a final violent, angry, rage-filled signature, and calmly, as far as we understand, left the home, got in his car, and went home. Later that day, her husband, David Wallen, returned home to that scene that would just traumatize the poor, poor man. The house was obviously quiet, but when he walked in and saw everything, the chilling scene, I can't imagine what he went through and the, you know, the things that we know of about him afterwards, just really,
based
really
on
rough.
The description of what.
Yeah. Yeah.
Happened to her. I can't even imagine what that would look like. That would be terrible.
And the police who responded to his frantic call were also hardened professionals, but they were also utterly unprepared for what they would walk into in that bedroom. The savage brutality of the scene was beyond anything any of the officers had ever encountered in their entire careers. The mutilation, the disembowelment, the obvious ritualistic nature of like what happened in here. One of the police officers said it looked like a vision straight out of hell. Investigators realize now that this is not just a random one-off murder, that this was the work of someone not only profoundly disturbed, but someone who may be an actual serial killer in their neighborhood on their hands now. And in that moment, the baffling Ambrose Griffin shooting from a month earlier snapped into focus for a couple of the officers. Now, this wasn't seen as an anomaly. And while I have said and did say that the police officers fucked up multiple times by not grabbing onto this guy when they had him, not realizing who he was, this is one of the few cases where once they have an idea of what's going on, the police seem to actually give a damn and try. And we'll see that actually pay off. The fact that they were connected these two immediately spoke well, but unfortunately it wasn't enough to stop him from doing more murders beforehand. But they were almost certainly connected for them. In Sacramento, they now knew had potential serial killer on their hands who was wandering their streets. And while that may have brought a sense of relief to them, that relief was short-lived. The residence on the Wallen discovery was January 23rd, and it would only be a few days again before he would step out and murder for the third time. Now, this is where we talk about how people debate, and I know we talked about it last week, but the debate, the serial killer nature or spree killer nature, because while it's over the course of like a month, there was the Ambrose Griffin killing, 3.5 weeks of nothing, then about 5 days where he killed five other people. And then that was the end of it. It was very much a burst. And while it sounds like a long time in the context of his story, it's like one killing along about 3.5 weeks of nothing and then a burst killing. So whether he is a serial killer or not, I still don't know if I'd put him in serial killer or spree killer, but like it is semantics. If there's anybody who listens, I know we have a few people who are like in the psychiatry field. I don't know if there's still a definitive difference between the two. I'd be curious if whoever's listening who would know the difference knows why better than we do there is a difference, and if this guy was one or the other. Because, like I said, this guy just immediately started going out and being more violent after this. Like, this kill where he was up close personal mutilating it snapped something in him where he was just, okay, I'm going to do this again.
I mean, when you're at the point you're cutting off nipples, like, there's no going back. Like, that's taking a shit in a crib. That's like assholes can do that. You don't have to be like a truly diabolical evil person.
Wise words.
This dude went in, he like cut her up, disemboweled her, and then like, you know what, for good measure, off with the nipple. Like, that's, you're, there's, nah, dude, that's too much.
Off with the nipple.
Yeah, that's too much.
Maybe that's where he drank from to have the blood go into him. I'm just trying to find the logic why he did it. You know what I mean?
Because he's fucking a little bitch. She's a little tiny bitch with a ding dong that don't work. And he's so upset. Like, yeah, just screw him.
He's blood. Obviously,
in your mind, you're saying he's like, well, that's where the milk comes from. So that's where the blood should come from.
Yeah,
that's what you think he was thinking.
That's where I think he was thinking. That was what he was logic. He was very wrong.
He's like, that's how it works.
That's how it works. And obviously, because it's the 70s, there's not a lot going on back then either. This murder made its way across the media, across the community. And the effect this particular murder had on the community was immediate. Apparently, gun stores were flooded with terrified citizens, who had never owned a weapon in their entire lives, were now buying handguns. Shotguns were flying off the shelves. Hardware stores apparently were selling out of deadbolts, window locks, chains for the doors, wooden dowels for jamming sliding glass doors. This was a city that had felt safe forever, like a fortress, and now felt like they had been completely violated and were horrified. Mm. And the Vampire of Sacramento nickname was now about to be picked up on. But yeah, you like, look how we reacted to the fucking like COVID-19 with all the toilet paper going off. Like, you know, this is a time where gun laws are even looser than they are today to some degree. People were going to go arm themselves. The Sacramento police, for the Sacramento Police Department, the situation had now escalated from that frustrating cold case to an all-out crisis. They were facing a killer of a type they had never dealt with before, and the public was demanding answers they just didn't fucking have. They were, however, able to make one grim but brutally crucial connection. While the method was drastically different from the Griffin shooting to the weapon, the weapon was still the same. The bullets found in the recent victim were 22 caliber, just like the one that was found in Griffin. So there was still that connection. This was a revelation for them. Now they're trying to figure out why the method was different. How could, for them right now, how they were thinking to themselves, how could the same person be as a disorganized psychotic mutilator and also a detached cold sniper? They're looking for patterns because that's what they're trained to look for when there really isn't a pattern here other than the weapon. The two crime types contradicted each other, and they painted a portrait of somebody who was just unpredictable or potentially in their mind evolving. And that also was unpredictable. This for them, again, to the police department's credit, they realized they were facing a depth and breadth of something they were not ready for. So they made a call that would become standard police practice in the decades to come, but was at the time a kind of new and novel approach. They decided to reach out to the FBI's budding behavioral science unit in Quantico, Virginia, of which they're learning the behavioral sciences thing are learning from one of the killers we've talked about before, Bumblebutt Ed Kemper. You remember us talking about Ed Kemper?
Yeah, I know exactly who that is. That was a stupid nickname.
That was him from the show, from Mindhunter, right?
Yes. Yeah. That's him, Mindhunter. We also did talk about him. Like, we did a series on him in this show as well. But like, he was the first serial killer to like work with and just openly talk about his motivations and why. And this bureau that is now around and like has that information, this police department's reaching out to. They're like, and this is a whole new thing. This was the era where men like Robert Ressler and John Douglas, agents who were at the very moment developing the new field of psychological profiling, which at the time was actually kind of controversial. The data from Wallen and Griffin crime scenes was relayed over to them, and they began to construct a theoretical portrait of the man they were hunting in the area. The profile they built, though, was actually chillingly accurate. They told the Sacramento police that they were not looking for a criminal mastermind like they thought they might be. They were actually looking for a young, white male, likely in his mid to late 20s. He would be a profound loner, socially inept, and almost certainly unemployed, likely living in some form of disability or family support. His residence, the FBI predicted, would be a complete mess, reflecting his own internal disorganized and chaotic state of mind at the time, and that he would likely be thin, undernourished, and filthy, as he would neglect his own personal hygiene and nutrition. They surmised he had a known history of mental illness, specifically paranoid schizophrenia, and likely had a history of drug and alcohol abuse, that he would not be a sophisticated killer who stalked victims.
I mean, fucking nailed it.
Like, they did, and they obviously, most of this comes from what he did to the body after the killing. The fact that she was killed and then he did all of his horrible shit after it showed that, like, again, somebody who doesn't, you can wait for an opportunity to be alone with somebody to take out on somebody who can't talk back, who can't say anything, who can't make fun of him. Like, they're just putting together the incel, you know, in a weird way. They also said that he was probably opportunistic and struck at random if the opportunity arose, which fit the profile of how he would check doors. Most critically, though, they warned that a killer this disorganized and driven by whatever powerful internal fantasy would not be able to stop themselves. They would keep killing until you caught them. That the Wallen murder that they had with this grandiose body desecration wasn't a grand finale, but this was likely a huge escalation and it would only get worse from here. He had now successfully performed his quote unquote ritual, and the relief that he felt from it would only be temporary, which is them learning from serial killers how they go into a cool down period and come back. And he was, they warned, almost certainly going to kill again, and he would do it soon. The FBI's profilers were exactly correct. Richard Chase, the murder of Teresa Wallen. For Richard Chase, the murder of Teresa Wallen had been a life-altering success because he'd finally done it. He had satisfied the horrifying, desperate thirst of his psychosis that had been created, and he had consumed the blood and organs of a victim and had, in his mind, staved off his own internal decay, finally with the blood of a human, and no longer that of animals. But obviously his mental illness, surprise and prize, didn't get cured after this.
No way. No way, dude.
I know, kind of weird.
I was banking on that, dude.
Yeah, I know. I was hoping that after that, he'd just be able to end, you know, he'd be able to go live a peaceful life.
And he started a village. Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the powdering of his blood was a chronic condition. Before we move forward, though, Jesse, visually, the audio listeners can't see, but you looked like you wanted to say something. You were tip-tapping your fingers together.
No, I was just listening to you go on with, like, it's just, these are always a lot, but they're fascinating looks at the human psyche. Even though their actions are truly insane, I get why psychologists get into, like, criminal psychology, because it's fascinating to look at, like, this is what happens to people sometimes,
right? That's I'm the same way. That it's so fascinating to see and see patterns in all of the killers, and yet also know that tons of people grew up in the same kind of conditions that didn't turn into these people. And like, what are the unique markers for them in particular?
I mean, I think that's why we ended up at the idea of the head trauma, or I'm sure people with real degrees in this who've studied for years have their guesses as well. It's like, what's the thing that ticks someone over? Or is it one of those, like, we all have the capacity, you know, like that?
Right.
Like, yeah, there's definitely something. I don't know. I have no clue.
To fit into that serial killer mode that we're talking about, a lot of serial killers do a kill, go into a cooling off period, kill, and then it's a shorter cooling off period, but still pretty long. Richard Chase, his longest cooling off period was the 3.5 weeks between his Griffin and Wallen here, because the next cooling off period lasted 4 days and went from January 23rd to January 27th, where he that was his cooling off period. But for Chase, there was no time of calm, but what he called a time of absorption. He was processing his new power as the blood was working its way into his system. And as the days ticked on by, the old familiar terror of his illness began to creep back in just a few days later. I imagine the absorption process lasted a good 24 hours, and then he started getting nervous again.
Do you think he thought he felt grains running through his veins?
Oh, yeah, I bet. I bet you he felt like he caught that shit.
But I'm like, I wonder.
No, it's crazy, dude. Like, again, I'm speaking from and not experience of this, but living with somebody who was very schizophrenic. Like, the shit my mom truly saw and like thought was happening, right, or like speaking with, is crazy. Even when she like at when we were finally like she forgot finally getting help, you know, one of the first times where she knew she was hallucinating, she still, you know, was telling us in the mental hospital, like, she was seeing a donkey with a monkey on it, riding donkey, walking into the room. And we were watching her. She like stopped mid sentence, was watching this thing, but like, it is real. Like, to them, your brain is just being like real, real, real. You're smelling it. It's triggering your olfactory senses. It's triggering your auditory senses. And it makes you wonder
why others can't see it. And yeah, that's fascinating. It's going back to the episode about the going underwater and getting nitrogen sickness. Like,
right,
the human brain is
insanity.
Yeah, man.
There's a study, I forget what it's called, but there's also a really cool study about they did where they disconnected the hemispheres of the brain, and each one has its own separate consciousness. And they would test, they would communicate it. Yeah, they would. It's all done in labs. They've done it many, many times.
That's fucking
crazy. And the way one could only communicate via drawing, and the other one could only communicate via writing. And like, they would deafen one ear and an eye because that was just one hemisphere, and they would do it to the other. And they were two separate. And it was an immediate conscious that would just emerge out of the other one. And the thing they did they learned recently is if you disconnect it completely, that side of the brain goes to sleep, and it like kind of falls into a sleep. It's which people's like they're two that are one, like the idea that you might actually be two separate identities that are working together to create a singular identity.
They're two wolves, dude.
They're two wolves inside you, dude.
How the fuck am I supposed to rectify that with like my experience on this planet? It's so crazy to think
about. I don't know. It's a crazy cool thing to go read about, though. Like, human minds are insane. So yeah, I do think he thought like his blood was fucking dusting and he was dying, and the cure was already wearing off just a couple days in, and that thirst for blood would quickly return before the pressure would mount and build again. And this time, though, he knew exactly how to relieve it fully. So after 4 days, he went back to his car with his pistol and his kit of knife, and he began to prowl the streets looking for an open door, yet another invitation. The FBI profilers had warned the police that their man would kill again, and quickly, and they were correct. The cure Richard Chase had administered to himself with the blood of Wallen had a surprisingly short half-life. So as he began wandering again, he would find another one. Friday, January 27th in 1978, where he was in the back. He was back in his car. He had his 22 caliber pistol. And as he was looking for his next invitation, he would find a door open on La Gloria Drive. I don't know if that you're not from Sac. You're not in Sacramento.
No, so you probably I don't know nothing about no Sacramento.
Yeah, he was trying door after door after door, locked, all locked. Some of them locked, but then locked by a deadbolt, until eventually on La Gloria Drive, he found one that was open. And with that, he stepped in. The home belonged to 38-year-old Evelyn Miroth, but the house was far from empty. Evelyn was babysitting her 22-month-old nephew, David Ferreira. Her 6-year-old son, Jason, was also there. And visiting the family was a friend, 50-year-old Daniel Meredith. And this was just another unsuspecting, normal home life scene that he steps into, that he just steps like a horror movie, just breaks it all. Like the lighting and the scenery changes. We're like on camera for a horror movie where things are in a bright little comfy orange. Everything dims, everything gets cold because he quietly steps into the room. And the sequence of events that immediately followed pieced together from the horrific scene that was seen afterward represents kind of this is the peak of his violent frenzy. The first person he encountered was Daniel Meredith, who was reportedly standing in the hallway. There was no time for a struggle. Chase was very efficient when he stepped in. He just raised his 22 and shot Meredith once in the head, killing him instantly.
Jesus fucking Christ.
With Meredith removed, he moved further in. The sound of a small caliber weapon was not loud, easily mistaken again for a car like backfiring or book dropping on the floor, if it was even heard by the others in the house. Chase then moved deeper into the house. Now he's looking for further life, and he found Evelyn Amiroff and her 6-year-old son, Jason. He simply shot them both. Jason was shot in the head twice. He then moved to the 22-month-old toddler, David Ferreira, who was in his playpen, and shot him in the head as well. In the span of what's likely less than 2 minutes, 4 people were killed, and the house was suddenly unnervingly silent. The murders were now complete, but obviously there was more to that he had to do. This was, in his mind, the harvest period again. He immediately focused his attention on the body of Evelyn Miroff. He dragged her corpse from where she had fallen into a bedroom. Here in the privacy of this desecrated space, he performed the full grotesque ritual that he rehearsed with Teresa Wallen. He engaged in necrophilia again. He used the knife to inflict extreme post-mortem sexual mutilation on her body, slicing open her abdomen again and disemboweling her like he did with Teresa. And this was the intersection of all of his pathologies, the homicidal angry rage, that profound sexual dysfunction, and the post-mortem potency of his cure that would hopefully cure his vampiric delusion, sure, dominating it. He collected and drank her blood and consumed parts of her organs in a desperate psychotic act of another self-medication. The treatment of the other victims provides yet another look kind of into his insanity. Daniel Meredith was, again, just an obstacle, and he was just killed and left where he fell. However, a 6-year-old Jason, though, found shot in the same room as his mother, was otherwise also left untouched. His body was not part of any of the ritual, which, again, shows the sexual fucking driving factor that might be feeding his psychosis. The reason why people say he's also potentially a serial killer here. It all everything pointed to in the crime scene that the focus was on the woman, everything on Evelyn Miroff in this house. But he still did something new that baffled investigators and added a new weird dimension to his crimes. He went to the playpen. He did not perform a ritual on the 22-month-old toddler, but instead, he picked up the child's body and he took it with him. He abducted the 22-month-old corpse.
What? What the fuck, dude?
Which was a wild deviation from any of the patterns that he had before. And we honestly actually do not know what the motivation for this was.
He's acting like a fucking jaguar is what it is. He's taking it up into his fucking tree or some shit.
Well, that's what it was like. We don't know if it was a trophy, like serial killers collect. If so, weird trophy. Was it like to go container? Like, is this like food to go? Like, is he going to take this home and heat it up for dessert? Like, we don't fucking know why he did it.
Valid question.
Because it could simply be Occam's razor, like a disorganized impulsive act of the chaos. Like, who knows why he did it?
Right.
But he still did. He still freaking took it. And then his exit out of this place was frantic. In his haste, he left behind a huge amount of forensic evidence. The house was a mess of bloody handprints and footprints that obviously would all go back to a man who had been arrested and put in a psychiatry ward multiple times. His bloody shoe footprints were perfectly preserved, and the investigators would later actually confirm that they were a match to a print left in Teresa Wallen's house. The ballistics were also the same. The shoe prints the same. The handprints matched his, and the link to them, this was it. He was so messy. He left everything they needed to connect him, not only to all the other ones, but it was him.
Complete lost his mind at this point. Just not even thinking anymore. Just doing
right.
This.
Yeah. He just complete lost in his own mind. He thought he was just going to get away with everything. And he fled the house carrying the body of the murdered toddler. And he, in his mind, needed to get away. And his own car was likely parked out front where it could be identified. So he made a panic decision instead. He grabbed the keys to Daniel Meredith's car. He stole the victim's vehicle and fled the scene instead, which was a very amateurish decision, for having killed two people, two different groups of people.
Do you think panic set in after he the choices he's making right now seem crazy, but like on a whole other level of no actual thought going into it? Like, I almost wonder if in some way the reason he took the baby was because, like, I think he's like, yeah, I killed a baby. If they find this baby, I'm in a lot of trouble.
That's way worse.
So he's like, yeah, I'm going to hide it. Like, that would some way help.
Yeah, but to the point of, like, the stupid decisions he's making, like, after he stole the car, he drove it a few blocks away and then abandoned it. And the location he chose was, like, a unbelievable in its stupidity. He parked and abandoned the car a few hundred yards away from his own apartment building on Watt Avenue. Just like in effect, kind of just a big old, like, I live here, kind of just out his front door.
Everyone.
Yeah, just the stolen cars outside of his apartment, not far away.
You out there murdering stuff? Yeah, yeah, I am, Mrs. P. Okay.
He just fucking did it. He just fucking went and did it.
He obviously had some time because the discovery of the scene wouldn't be immediate at La Gloria Drive. When the first officers respond to the call, again, like the other officers walked into the other one, they walked into another profound scene of chaotic violence. That looked somewhat, another police officer for this one said it looked like a slaughterhouse, more like a slaughterhouse than a suburban home. The sheer scale of the crime threw them off, like, was very, very, very concerning. It wasn't one victim. It was just a whole household that was annihilated. The officers, upon finding the body of Daniel Meredith, Evelyn Miroth, and 6-year-old son Jason, were now at another fucking horrible crime that they put on top of the one they found literally fucking 4 days ago. And further, if they discovered the body of, they further discovered the body of the rest of the family, took pictures after, of everything, really got it all on paper and recorded, got the footprints, got the handprints. And obviously, though, before the cops could do anything about stopping the media from covering it, this shit just immediately hit the headlines within 24 hours. But amid the chaos that was hitting the community, Chase made a series of critical, stupid mistakes in his disorganized, psychotic frenzy in his exit. He was just, it was obvious who this now was. No longer just a ghost crime. And obviously the most important thing was the car he took, because the cops put out what's known as a BOLO, or a be on the lookout for. And it was the car, which they had the fucking license plate to, the registration to. They knew exactly what they were looking for. And it was found super quickly abandoned. And when the police ran the location, I can't imagine what they must have felt when they ran the location, because the car was parked on Watt Avenue, which was just a few blocks away from where they had fled from the Miroth home. And this told the police that the suspect was not a criminal mastermind, not only by any stretch, but so disorganized and impulsive that he was probably local.
Yeah, because if you're dropping the car off close, then you could walk home. Yeah,
you could like literally get how. Yeah, how, you know, a way to get home.
Yeah. So their citywide search shrunk way down to just a few block radius. And at the same time, the police were tightening their physical net. Because they were now clicking into something into place that we talked about last week. Do you remember old school friend Nancy Holder, who we talked about in part one, who bumped into him in a supermarket?
I was like, oh, hey, oddly quicker. You're weird. Yeah.
She was watching the news, had a weird feeling that it might be him. And so she it put her all on edge. And she then remembered her bizarre encounter at the shopping center with her old high school acquaintance, Richard Chase. She remembered the way he looked. And the way his sunken eyes, his like the bloodstains on his sweatshirt, like, that you remember seeing. Probably
fucking him. Yeah.
Yeah. And so she was like, oh, fuck. The man she had seen, the man, the blood on his clothes, that might have been, and it wasn't human blood. But to her mind, she's like, oh, shit, that might have been blood. So she called the police and said, I think I know who your killer is. His name is Richard Trenton Case. And for the detectives, that was it. They had a name. They ran Richard Chase through the system, and his record must have lit up like a fucking Christmas tree. Like, his history of involuntary commitments at Beverly Manor popped up. That was my, like, a Boston accent came out of me for a minute. Beverly Manor. The diagnosis of a severe paranoid schizophrenia popped up. The Dracula nickname from the staff got popped up on that stuff. The Pyramid Lake incident with the cow's blood popped up. And then the final damning piece of evidence, a weapons registration for a .22 caliber semi-automatic pistol purchased just a month before the Griffin murder popped all up. All of that popped up. It was all a holy shit moment in this investigation. Basically, it was over. And what do you know? They looked up his address and they found that he lived in apartment number 2 at 2605 Watt Avenue, the same street, the same block where he put the stolen fucking car.
So dumb.
What? Like, it even blows my mind. Two independent leads and physical evidence was it. They had him. The ghost had a name for them. So a frantic call had gone out. The canvassing officers were already in the neighborhood, all redirected. And within minutes, a heavy armed stakeout was established outside the apartment surrounding Watt Avenue. And so they just sat there and they fucking waited. And the afternoon of the January 27th turned to evening. And at the scene of his apartment, it got even more tense. Uniformed officers and plainclothes detective formed a tight armed perimeter around Richard Chase's apartment building.
I would have been like, Richard,
you get out of here, Richard.
Hey, come here.
Well, because as far as they know, they think they're dealing with someone who's hyper violent. Maybe they'll start popping bullets out the window. Right, nobody really knows. Every officer on that stakeout knew like who they were looking for. They were just didn't know how violent this man was going to be. They were dealing with this is the vampire. They had the nickname vampire had made its way out to the public as well. Like that was just what he was known as. They basically wanted to also avoid a shootout hostage situation and ideally him killing himself. They did not want him to kill himself because they wanted to arrest the guy. Luckily, they didn't have to wait all that long. Once they, after a few hours passed, the front door of apartment number two opened and out emerged Richard Chase. And he was not acting like he was a man on the run. Apparently, he was just kind of like leaving his apartment, going to go carrying some cardboard box to take out to the corner. He had no idea the cops were out there. And they officers literally just watched him. Got their first look at him, clear look at Richard as a suspect.
Yep.
And this is it. They were like, yeah.
Look at this guy. Grab this guy. Like, look at the thumbnail of this video. Like, look at the actual thumbnail of this video just for a second if you're listening and look at him and be like,
yeah. That's just walking out with cardboard boxes acting like it's a normal day. And they're like, yeah, no, I think that's him. Yeah, that's definitely him. Apparently, also, as he was walking, he fumbled the box at one point and his wallet almost fell out of one of his pockets. One of the detectives, John P. Dutto, had his eyes locked on it. He was like watching. This is where a lot of this testimony comes from. But he actually, they approached and they could even see that the wallet that was in his pocket had Daniel Meredith's name on it.
Dude.
He was walking around with Daniel Meredith's wallet on him. Dude. Like, what are you doing, dude? So with that scene, that was their probable cause, and the order was given from the commanding officer of just take him in. So the officers drew their guns and they swarmed him. Maybe surprising to them, but maybe not surprising to us. There wasn't any violent shootout. Like there was no last stand attempted by this guy.
There never is with these types of guys. They're just always like, well, all right, I guess that's it. See ya.
He literally just did nothing. He crumpled to the ground, offered no resistance. One of the officers described him as ragdolling. He looked like a ragdoll when he went down. He just like just flopped down when the cops showed up.
Yeah.
And he apparently just was disassociated for like just went dead silent. And then at one point when they put the cuffs on him, he mumbled something to them quickly. And when the cops said to repeat yourself, all he said was to the officers, why?
He's going
to
say, this is going to ruin the tour.
And as, like a line straight out of a movie, the arresting officer just snapped back, for murder, you son of a bitch.
Yay. like, he said, for murder, fucking... you son of a bitch?
Yeah.
Now imagine if that was Mariska Hargitay who said that. Oh my God.
Yeah. Oh, shit. Who's that?
That's television, baby. That's an SVU episode.
That's TV, baby.
Okay. Yeah. so he had been caught and who knows if he thought he was being arrested by cops or Nazis in the UFOs had finally caught him or something. But the box he was carrying was taken away. And when the officers looked inside, they found it was filled with blood soaked rags and other paraphernalia from the rituals that he had just committed. And he was likely bringing it out to throw it away.
Those are my blood soaked rags for my rituals.
Yeah. Don't go through my blood soaked ritual rags.
Those are those. No.
Those are mine. Oh, I was going to have Alistair cummy cakes after, dude.
I was going to suck them so that my blood stopped turning to powder.
Yeah, so in a matter of seconds, this horrifying vampire Sacramento was just reduced to a tiny, shriveling bitch of a man, Richard Chase, who was filthy. Apparently, they said like he smelled awful, covered in blood, like he did not bathe.
Did you say a horrifying, shriveling bitch of a man?
Yeah.
Incredible.
Fuck yeah.
Thank you. They had him. It was done. In the back of the squad car, apparently officers were slightly confused because he kept asking if he could have a cigarette from the officers while he was being driven to the police, driven to jail. They went through his home, but they were still missing the body of the 22-month-old David Ferreira. They didn't know where he was. The hope of finding the child alive was non-existent at this point, but they still had a need of recovering him to give the extended family, you know, a measure of closure. And so they prepared themselves and walked into his apartment, not knowing what the fuck to expect. And I can imagine, you know, we've talked about some horrifying like crime scenes of serial killers in the past, and this one goes up there. The first thing that hit them, they all say, was the smell. It was overpowering, as every serial killer apartment seems to be. Just yeah. Smells like dead bodies. They said it was overpowering. A couple of the officers had to step out and throw up because of that gag-inducing physical wave of nausea that just hits.
I don't know why this part always bums me out so much, but it's like so gross and sad picturing this happening. Yeah,
right. You know, one of the officers also described it as like a mix of spoiled milk and like human shit that like mixed together. As they pushed inside, flashlights, as they beam the flashlight around, they say basically this is what the centerpiece of the trial would come to. This was not, like for them, this was like a I imagine it like rich, like Dahmer, right? He turned his apartment into like a ritualistic altar to trying to like his own weird shit, his own weird experiments of like creating a perfect boy Nazi, like not Nazi, Nazi, perfect boy slave, sex slave. This was like a messier ritualistic place where he was trying to replenish his own blood via drinking the blood of things. What they walked into was like disgusting. They said it was covered top to bottom in just filth, dried blood. What little furniture was there was smeared and caked with dried blood, both animal and, as they would also confirm via testing, human blood. The walls were pockmarked with bullet holes, if you remember from last episode, because he was just shooting his gun
yeah.
all over the place. Scattered around the floor, they found a grim collection of pet collars, trophies from dozens of animals that he had captured and killed and consumed. This place had been just a slaughterhouse before it was anything, even to human victims. In the kitchen, the scene became even more focused. On the counter, you saw blenders. Inside those blenders, they were caked with, as we talked about last week, brownish black residue of blood and tissue and a little bit of Coca-Cola.
Why the Coca-Cola, man?
Dude. Splash of Coke in there. And in the refrigerator, this is when the police officer pulled open the door and saw the source of most of the overwhelming stench. This was instead here, they were looking at Tupperwares and bowls and various all kinds of dishes, literally in the fridge, that were just human body parts. They would later catalog it all, meticulously write the reports of everything that was found, which contained brains, intestines, and other just various fucking organs that we have no need to go through all of them. They'd also found containers in various states of coagulation with the blood that he'd been stockpiling for a rainy day. Like he was really building a trophy, quote unquote, of leftovers, right. In a bizarre, strange way. But they also found blood-soaked rubber boots, a 12-inch butter knife, both of which had been tied directly to some murders. And then they also found his calendar, which on it had the marked dates of Wallen and Miroff's murders with the simple chilling word today written on it on the 27th. And he had marked 44 more dates on the calendar that he was planning to go out and find people to stake out and then murder if he had not been caught in this night. So like, again, there's the serial killer aspect argument of it all. He was clearly planning on doing it over and over and over again. Still, the one thing they didn't find was the body of David Ferreira. The apartment, a slaughterhouse as it was, but there was no missing child or the body of one. And there was just because of this lack of, it sent like the investigation, like really started honing in. They're trying to find the body of this 22-year-old. It almost felt like closure for them, the way I would read about how like, they really wanted to find the body of this boy. And the search for the child's body would just continue. While the forensic team was meticulously cataloging the house on Watt Avenue, detectives began the initial interrogation of Richard Chase. He was in their custody, still gross and ragdolly, but he was by all accounts cooperative. He waived his Miranda rights and literally just began to talk. And the detectives in the room got their first direct look into the abyss of this dude's psychosis. He readily admitted to everything. He never denied a damn thing. He admitted to killing Griffin, to killing Wallen, and to the massacre on La Gloria Drive. He did not confess to murder, though. In his mind, these weren't murders. He explained in a calm, rational, very matter-of-fact tone that his actions were simply acts of survival.
You laid out literally said exactly what I thought he was going to say. Like, you know, understand. He was like, it's no different than killing a cow to eat your meal.
Yeah, exactly correct.
Is that you?
Is that you, Aleister Crowley? He laid out his entire delusional framework for them. He explained as if it were like the most obvious shit in the world that his blood was being poisoned, possibly by the soap dish poisons his mother had warned him about, or by Nazis and UFOs, and that it was turning to powder, that his pulmonary artery had been stolen and his heart would stop beating if they'd only pay attention. And the only way that he could replenish his body and blood and stay alive, he explained calmly to them again, was to obtain a fresh supply from another source. He told them that it started with rabbits, but it soon wasn't enough, that he had no choice but to escalate, that his victims were not people, they were resources, that he told the stunned detectives that he wasn't a killer, he was the victim, and they were leaving their doors to invite him in to allow him to do this so that he could follow through. And his actions in her mind, in his mind, were justifiable homicide if he were going to label it as anything. He displayed no remorse or empathy, no understanding of the gravity of what he'd done, the gravity of the situation he was in. He was just explaining his medical treatments. Like, that's just what it came off as. He did, however, express a single bizarre note of frustration. He did complain to the detectives that he had tried to take a victim's blood in a cup, but that it had clotted too fast, and he had found the whole process very frustrating.
That must have sucked for him, dude.
Yeah, that's terrible.
Damn, dude.
Wow. Now with his reign of terror over and he's finally arrested, we will move into the trial against him, which didn't last super long, but it would be about a year after him being arrested that he would actually get into a trial. The legal case of the People v. Richard Trenton case was set to be kind of a sensational one in California history. The what was never in question. Chase had been caught literally, quite literally red-handed with the murder weapon and a victim's fucking wallet on him. He had already given
crazy.
And he had already given a full detailed and kind of just like bizarre confession to the cops. The evidence from his apartment was overwhelming. The trial was never going to be about, did he do it? It was more about, was he sane when he did it? And the prosecution was led by District Attorney Ronald W. Tuchterman, and it made its position clear from day one that they were seeking the death penalty. They intended to prove that while Chase was undoubtedly spectacularly mentally ill, he was, under the strict legal definition in California, sane. Their entire case would be built on the Manhattan rule, which was the legal standard, which was the law at the time, which was incredibly narrow. To be found legally insane, basically the defense at the time would have to prove that Chase at the time of the murders, either one, did not understand the nature of his actions, or two, did not know that his actions were wrong. That's the Manhattan rule. Like, that's how you are allowed to be insane. The prosecution's argument was that his actions proved he knew what he was doing was wrong. Why else, they argued, would he lie on the gun application form? Why would he flee the scene from the Gloria Drive massacre? Why would he steal a car to make his getaway? Why would he be carrying a box of bloody rags when he was arrested, if not to dispose of the evidence? All of these, they claimed, were the actions of a man who was fully conscious of his own guilt and was trying to avoid legal consequences. And on the other side, the court appointed a public defender named Robert P. Weeks to represent Chase, a man who was now the most hated person in the state. Weeks was facing an unwinnable battle, obviously in the court of public opinion, but he had a mountain of evidence for his own case. He was not just arguing that Chase was mentally ill. He was arguing that Chase was a textbook end stage paranoid schizophrenic, a man so completely detached from reality that he lived in an entirely different universe than everyone else. His defense would be, quote, not guilty by reason of insanity. They would argue that Chase couldn't know his actions were morally wrong because his delusions had completely replaced his morality. He didn't kill for pleasure or for greed. He killed because he genuinely 100% believed he was a medical patient and that these people were his medicine. He was a man. He was a man dying of a non-existent disease, and he had killed to save his own life. The state of his apartment, the blood-caked blenders, the Pyramid Lake incident, the Dracula nickname, its own bizarre matter-of-fact confession that it all painted a picture of a man who did not just fail the Manhattan test, but had never been in the right reality to even take it. So this set the stage for the back and forth battle of the experts that would go on for some time. The trial of Richard Chase began on January 2nd, 1979, like I said, about a year later after his arrest, and the intervening months had done nothing to dull the horror of his crimes. They had only allowed the public's fascination and disgust to curdle into a pure, focused demand for retribution on this guy. Over the past year, this man was just hated, and not rightfully so. The Sacramento courtroom became a media circus. This was the vampire killer trial, a case that seemed ripped from lurid pulp horror novels, and the public wanted to see the monster when he popped up. So when Chase was finally brought into the courtroom, the man they saw at now was no longer the wild-eyed, blood-soaked ghoul everybody had seen arrested, but he was just like a ghostly, kind of just pale, thin man, heavily medicated on antipsychotics. He was described by virtually every reporter as like zombie-like. Like that he just kind of shuffled in and shuffled out of the courtroom because he was heavily medicated. He was thin, pale, and seemed completely disassociated from the proceedings, often sitting and doodling on a legal pad, just not really mentally there. The ragdoll, as he became known as nickname, was at the center of a legal war, was never again about what happened, but what was going to happen to him. Was he going to get sent off to a mental institution, or was he going to get put to death or get put away for life? So the questions that we asked earlier started coming up. And then, of course, they started bringing up that and agreed that, yes, Chase was a paranoid schizophrenic, but the defense then argued that his psychosis didn't, or rather the offense argued that this psychosis didn't prevent him from understanding the law. They claimed he was capable of compartmentalizing and that his drug use, particularly his LSD use, had likely exacerbated his condition to the point of toxic psychosis, which in many legal interpretations could negate an insanity defense.
Sure.
There's another angle that he was working and saying that he was still, in their expert opinion, legally responsible for his actions. Still, the other side did their best, tried to demonstrate that the Manhattan rule was a blunt, archaic legal instrument. He argued that applying the concept of right and wrong to Richard Chase was like asking a blind man to describe the color blue. But, you know, I fall on the side of the prosecution where like he actively took actions often to hide his guilt or like the fact that he actually did something. So the jury was basically trapped at this point. They were basically just caught in like, what are they? Is he insane or is he not insane? And what was going to happen? And on May 8th, 1979, after deliberating for only 5 hours, the jury returned its verdict. They found that Richard Trenton Chase was legally sane. On all 6 counts of first-degree murder, they found him guilty. The penalty phase was even quicker. The jury, having already decided he was sane, sentenced him to die in the gas chamber at San Quentin State Prison. The guilty verdict and subsequent death sentence were, for the public and the legal system, the end of the story. This is what they wanted. This was the end that they had hoped for in the entire year of media nonsense that circulated this entire thing. Richard Chase was transferred from the Sacramento County Jail to the most notorious prison of the state, San Quentin, the home of California's death row. But for Chase himself, the trial seemingly just was confusing because they medicated this man into the point where he just kind of wasn't aware of what's going on anymore. The antipsychotics just disassociated him from the reality of what was going on. And so he just quietly lived out the rest of his days on death row. And it was during this time on death row that it would make his most significant contribution to criminal science. His case had been a lightning rod for the FBI's budding behavioral science unit again, and the profilers who had so accurately described him while he was still at large. One of those profilers that we mentioned earlier, Robert Ressler, was conducting a wide-ranging, groundbreaking study, and he was traveling to prisons across the country to interview convicted serial killers, attempting to build a database of their minds, motivations, and methods that he could use. This was a study that would form the basis of the modern criminal profiling that would include men, like I said earlier, like Ed Kemper, Ted Bundy, Richard Chase, though, what is the moment, their next prize subject. And so we did a number of interviews with him, and it was these recorded sessions with Chase in his own words that laid his entire shattered psyche bare. This is how we know so much about how he was like mentally operating, his unlocked door theory. And in that way, at the very least, Chase was useful to them in some way. But he wouldn't need
his
end here.
I don't even want to hand that to him, though. I want to hand that to the people that did the...
To the FBI directors for like actively like going about it, for the police for reaching out to them when they knew they were maybe in over their head, for a new branch of the FBI that was not even really all that well tested yet. Phenomenal work all the way around.
Right.
And that's it. Like, for what ended up happening, how he died though, was that for months he had started cheeking his medication, pretending to swallow his pills while the guards watched, and then hoarding them in a secret stash. He had accumulated a lethal dose, and on Christmas night, he had finally decided to take it. And that was it. The death of Richard Chase was a quiet, anticlimactic end to this chaotically violent story, who would earn him the nickname the Vampire of Sacramento. And while his execution was never carried out, and he got his own exit, quote unquote, it was still in a very solitary place, locked away from society after being a useful tool to greater purposes for the FBI and crime fighting at large. And with his death and his story told, we bring this two-parter to a close, boys. And that is the story of Richard Chase. How are we feeling about that one?
Like, look, I said maybe because we're doing Spooky Month, we could do some sort of, you know, serial, like go back to true crime, do some sort of, you know, case. I got, you know, you fuck around, you get fucked. A guy asked for the monkey paws finger went down, and we got Coca-Cola animal organ slurry.
Yeah.
So, you know, there you go. I was deeply disturbed to the point that I became non-responsive almost at parts because it was so upsetting.
Well, yeah. What are you going to say? You know, there's nothing you can like, it's just the reality of what happened. How about you, Jesse? How are you feeling after all that? Final thoughts on it.
Once again, I think it shows that for all the big feet and or aliens and or portals to other dimensions, the scariest thing we talk about on the show is human beings brutalizing other human beings.
Yeah.
Because it's real and it happened and you can't deny it. And it's crazy. There is no like, well, maybe it could be fake. No. These guys did this and their reasonings are always weird and twisted and exists kind of in a space that the average person will never truly understand. Cause like, it's not a space that's logical or sound or, you know, like it's just messed up.
No.
Yeah.
If you are like interested in the psychological aspect of it, like Richard Chase is one of those serial killers that has so many books written about him because of his psychological state and intrigue and like how his brain was working and stuff. If you want more, there's so much more, you know, you basically get the highlighted Mathis punched up version of the story, but there's so much more he did, and he is a fascinating case if that is your world of interest or education. So, there's some great authors out there. Go check them out. I highly encourage you to do so. But we're going to go off and do a minisode for Patreon where there will be no violence. I have no violence for this minisode, but we got some cool stuff to talk about. I'm very excited about it.
Righteous.
Yeah, we're all. Thank you guys so much. Righteous. Thank you so much. I'll see you next week. We appreciate you. Love you.
Bye.
Au revoir.
Anyway. Me and my wife were sitting outside indulging on our porch one night, enjoying ourselves. I needed to go to the bathroom, so I stepped back inside, and after a few moments, I hear my wife go, "Holy shit, get out here!" So I quickly dash back outside, and she's looking up at the sky in awe. I look up too, and there's a perfect line of dozen lights traveling across the sky.